This is the La Carre Cast.
Hello and welcome back to the Carre Cast. Jeff here. I am returning once again to talk to Mac Rogers, the acclaimed playwright and audio dramatist, about the BBC's George Smiley dramas. Be sure to go back and listen to parts 1 and 2, where we talked about Mac's writing journey and the 1-2 punch of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor's Soldier Spy. But in this last episode, I am excited we're talking about the remaining Smiley audio dramas, because there is some great stuff in them. We've got The Honorable Schoolboy, Smiley's People, and, of course, The Secret Pilgrim. So, moving on to The Honorable Schoolboy, what do you think about that one, Sport?
Yeah, obviously, I'm blanking on the actor's name. Very famous guy.
Hugh Bonneville, right?
Right. Now world famous for Downton Abbey. Obviously, he's great fun as Westerby. My favorite thing about Honorable Schoolboy is you kind of get a glimpse. If John le Carré had any inclination toward writing a cozy series of spy mysteries, like if he was going to crank out one a year with the same heroes where they could just kind of go on a spy adventure every year, you kind of get the one sort of glimpse of what that might look like, because you have all those wonderful and wonderful for audio drama, really well suited for audio drama scenes where Smiley, Connie, Sax, Gwillem, and Dr. Salas put their heads together and go through the information in front of them. There's so many of these other novels where Smiley's alone for long stretches of time and you have to figure out how to get inside his head as a radio dramatist, and that's always so difficult to do. But in this one, you get this core brain trust team, all of whom are very appealing characters, all of whom have very different styles of speaking, well cast with actors, none of whom sound like each other. You get the most Connie Sax, which to me is just like, she improves every single scene that she's in. You get to have a group of experts conferring on what they're good at, which is exhilarating to listen to. So however I felt about anything else in the story, I loved getting to kind of check in with the brain trust team. But John le Carré ultimately has never been the kind of guy who's going to deliver a bunch of cozy mystery novels. The thing is always going to come down at the end, and there's always going to be irrevocable changes at the end, and we never get before or since another novel with this super fun brain trust conferring with each other. But it sure is great for audio drama.
The Smiley Scooby Gang.
Yes. Le Carré just simply, he does not believe in a cozy universe where you get to solve mysteries with the Scooby Gang every time. You just know this, but you get a quick glimpse into parallel universe, John le Carré here. And those scenes are just incredibly, incredibly fun to listen to. And there's one, for me, sensational scene. I could imagine people would have different feelings about it, where Smiley goes to meet Lizzie's parents. That scene is just brutal and incredibly dark, but incredibly well acted, as the way that they talk to Smiley about Lizzie gradually reveals everything that is broken and messed up in this family, particularly in the way that the mother has sort of learned to just kind of survive with this awful father. And as Smiley gradually just sort of gradually coaxes all the horror of this upbringing out of them, I just found that to be a very well written, directed, and performed scene that really struck me.
Yeah.
Oh, I made a note of a wonderful exchange. Dr. Salas had to go talk to a source that he's found, and Smiley says, "You go with him, Connie. You're good with old men." And she goes, "It's all those years I practice on you, George." I didn't get to reread the novel, so I don't know if that's straight from the novel, but I absolutely loved that exchange. I loved the line, in our game, there's two views of history, conspiracy and screw-up. And I kind of feel like most of Le Carré's novels and the way that they're realized in these radio dramas are kind of a combination of those two. You tend to find that there is a lot of conspiracy, and then the conspiracy is complicated by the fact that a lot of stuff gets messed up in the course of it. I want to call out one particularly wonderful Simon Russell Beale line reading where he's just had a meeting with the Americans and puts up a big fight about giving up some intelligence on one of the Coen brothers, but doesn't reveal that there's a whole other co-brother that he hasn't even talked. And Gwillem was like, "You didn't even mention the other brother." And Smiley says very dryly about the Americans. He says, "Well, one doesn't like to burden them." But Simon Russell Beale's delivery of that is just chef's kiss, superb. And then one audio drama moment that is, you know, I talk about a lot of things that are very hard to depict in audio drama. and you always have to find creative ways of doing it, is a scene where a character comes in and finds a corpse. So that character is all by themselves. No one else is there. They're not going to say out loud, "My God, a corpse." So how do you depict that? This is very well done. Jerry Westerby, again, well played by Hugh Bonneville. He shows up at home. I think Luke is the name, his flatmate who gets killed in his place. He comes in, he thinks Luke has just let the place go to seed. He hasn't washed the dishes. And you hear the flies buzzing, the sound design with the flies buzzing. And he goes, "What, Luke, you haven't washed any dishes. There's flies as fat as, oh." And as an audio drama listener, you could fill that in. You hear the flies and you hear him suddenly say, "Oh," and pause in horror. You put that together with the flies and instantly you know there's a corpse there. It's a way of establishing something without having to write a leaden expository line of dialogue. So I thought that Sean McKenna, you know, once again, did a great job with that. I'm not very well placed to speak to how the depictions of Asian characters are in the story. You never know to what degree that passes from fully well-rounded or versus caricature. And also those characters are very much, you know, supporting characters. It really does heavily focus around the Westerners. The performances certainly were good. And obviously I know Le Carré tended to visit places and do a lot of research, but you know, that's just something that I noticed. Those were kind of like the random little bits that I thought were worth calling out specifically in terms of audio drama.
Yeah. Well, and the corpse thing is actually a good segue to Smiley's people, because we also get another finding of a corpse in that one.
Sure.
And how did that one compare for you? Did that one work? I thought it worked actually pretty well with Simon Russell Beale's kind of sad lamentations over the death of the character.
Oh, you're talking about Otto Leipzig on the houseboat. Okay, yeah. I knew there were two different corpses. Although, yeah, there's only one that Smiley specifically discovers, which is Otto Leipzig on the houseboat. Yeah. Which leads into something that's very tricky. As an audio drama writer, I'm often like hired to write stuff where they don't have that much, you know, budget for actors. And I'll find myself stuck in scenes where a character is alone, which is something I avoid like the plague if I possibly can, because suddenly you've got a character talking to themselves, which almost never works. But
yeah,
it does work if it's well transposed Le Carré dialogue and it's Simon Russell Beale saying it. Maybe in other hands, that could be clumsy, that he like comes in, he sees the corpse of Otto Leipzig on the houseboat, and he kind of starts talking to himself about, like, he sees the signs that he put up a fight and he honors his courage and everything like that. I could imagine that exact same approach being incredibly clumsy in lesser hands, like, you know, you forced some of the prose in the book to be there, you know, and you suddenly got this character talking to himself, and why is he talking to himself or whatever. But it's so well transposed from the novel, it's so well written, and then mainly it's just so beautifully performed by Simon Russell Beale that we accept it as a trope of audio drama. This is a thing that happens in audio drama sometimes, which is that a character who is by themselves has to monologue about what they're experiencing. Smiley's people is absolutely rampant with this, because a huge chunk of the novel is just George Smiley very quietly going from one place to another, very incrementally putting his case together before he brings in Enderby and Lakin later on. So you've got to not be taken out of the moment by all of this stuff where Smiley talks to himself. And I would never write it this way, because I would think that it would bomb, but I have to admit, I don't know whether it's the writing or whether it's the fact that Simon Russell Beale can save anything, it does genuinely work. I think of this as the most challenging of the novels to adapt, because so much of it is Smiley's private odyssey through all these specters of his past, and it's so interior. And it's so methodical and step by step that you got the wonderful scenes when he goes to people, when he goes to, you know, Willem and Stella, or with Mikhail, or with the club owner Kretschmar or whatever. But in between, as the mystery is assembling in his head, there's so much of him being alone. But Simon Russell Beale's great at pulling off the monologues. And once again, you have the wonderful, wonderful thing that we celebrate throughout all of these, which is the wonderful inner dialogue with Anne. And Anna Chancellor really gets an opportunity in this one to show the sharp distinctions between inner voice Anne and real life Anne, who I think we bump into a couple of times in this story.
Yeah, no, and I think the thing that makes that one scene with the corpse work is that he's like kind of talking to the dead person, you know, he's kind of describing what he's seeing, but while he's talking to him, and I think that's what really makes it work is his performance. You feel like he's like really upset about what happened, and he plays it perfectly. It was really great.
Yeah, definitely.
So in this one, it seems like you would say that this is maybe the hardest one to adapt into an audio drama. Would you agree with that? Is this the one with the most landmines?
Definitely. So much of it is Smiley's interior journey. That's murder on audio drama. And then part of it is just length. It's a long novel. I listened to the audiobook version read by Michael Jason, which I think was like 14 hours long. And it's funny, by the time I had listened to this on audiobook, I'd listened to a bunch of the audio dramas. As I was listening, I did kind of find myself wondering how the adaptation was going to work. This was a Robert Forrest adaptation. I did find myself wondering what stuff would be cut down. I definitely guessed a few things correct, you know, right off the bat. I was like, there's no way you can, on an audio drama especially, this deep into a cycle that's focused on George Smiley, you can't start with the long Ostrakova chapter. You can't start, especially the long Willem chapter. I even think the Willem chapter is like maybe kind of a mistake in the novel because it doesn't remotely seem like there's enough payoff to spend that much time in Willem's perspective, unless it's just purely just to get to know this interesting character well. I think Robert Forrest made exactly the right choice to start with Smiley standing over Vladimir's corpse. He sees it over the course of the scene, not just his sadness about this agent of his, but like hearing the way other people talked about him, gradually becoming more enraged, gradually getting more dedicated to finding out what happened here. I can't remember the name of the young agent, but he's a young agent with the circus. He's the one who took the original call, and he's talking about his original contact with Vladimir in front of everybody. And the actor does a good job of doing what's described in the novel, which is like, he says, he told me to tell you, and then he realizes he shouldn't say it in front of his boss or in front of Enderby or anybody else. And he cuts himself off. He says, he told me to tell you it's Moscow rules, which is something that he already said. He just repeats something he was saying earlier. The way that the actor delivers it, you can believe that Smiley would notice that he held something back, but that the other people present wouldn't notice it. He plays it just subtly enough that only Smiley is smart enough to notice that he held something back. So Smiley takes him aside a minute later and says, what did you not say in front of everyone else? And the younger circus guy says, he said it has to do with the Sandman. And that's what sets Smiley off on this extraordinary odyssey. So yeah, you know, I admired that they started off, especially this deep into the cycle. You want to start with Smiley. I don't think that those prologues, they're well written in the novel. I don't object to them being there in the novel, but I don't think either the long Ostrakova prologue or the long Willem prologue pay off enough in the narrative. I think it's great to start with Smiley, and then we get to know those people later. Particularly, we get to know Willem through the prism of his very protective wife, Stella. Then we meet Ostrakova later when what she has to say is important to the story. It's kind of an interesting, in the novel, Le Carré introduces Ostrakova at the very beginning and keeps checking in with her throughout. Maybe you could argue that in Smiley's People, Maria Ostrakova is kind of the Prideaux of that novel. She's the person who gets pushed around by everybody and harmed by everybody. So it's nice that she gets her own little kind of sequestered bit of the novel. And it's kind of nice that things turn out okay for her because I was so sure she was doomed. But I think that the adaptation makes the smart move of like jumping us right in with Smiley, following him through the story so that we basically construct the mystery with him. We basically get each piece of information as he does. And is, of course, helped along by Anna Chancellor's wonderful performance. And then, of course, I got to call it out, the extraordinary Connie Sachs scene. Maybe even the very best one, because, you know, she's really at death's door in this one, and her past and present are warring among her. The way that the scene is written in the novel, she's given a number of extreme mood swings during the course of the, where she wants Smiley to go away, she wants to get drunk, she wants to talk about this stuff. There's a moment where she breaks down and begs to come back, begs to be part of the hunt for Carla, and then immediately switches tack and wants her younger girlfriend, Hillary, to come in and say this bizarre bromide about love being ripples on the water, and which is so hard to play. And Maggie Steed nails it. Maybe the second best performance after Simon Russell Beale in this whole cycle, or maybe third after Anna Chancellor. Just all of the bizarre journeys that Connie goes through in this scene. And it's just so deeply moving, but also very funny. Like, Connie always gets the funniest stuff to say. The character is just pure gold, especially for audio drama. And then, you know, once Smiley has built up enough of a case that he can go to Enderby and Lakin, then it becomes much easier to make this into audio drama because suddenly you're back in the field of a bunch of colleagues conferring and making notes about what they're going to do. You have a bunch of circus-related agents and superiors and higher-ups swapping information, swapping exposition that it makes sense that they would be saying to each other, that's motivated. You can feel that the adaptation process suddenly gets a lot easier as soon as Smiley brings in allies on this search. But being George Smiley, he's not going to bring in other people until he's absolutely sure that he's meticulously built the case. So it takes quite a while to get there. I was amazed at how many of Smiley's stops along the way make it into this three-hour adaptation. I wasn't sure if the scene with Mikhail would make it in, but it's there. It does full honor to the Stella and Willem scene. He manages to have both full conversations with the club owner. Robert Forrest manages to work in both scenes with Kretschmar, both before and after Smiley goes to the house and finds Otto Leipzig's body. I have to admire, he really did a really good job of getting most of the beats of the novel into this. If I was adapting it, I would have tried to figure out how there would be only one visit to Kretschmar. That, you know, somehow Smiley finds the houseboat first and then comes to him with the card or whatever. But Forrest managed to figure out how to work it all in. But then once he brings in everybody, then like it suddenly, you know, you have the very exciting conclusion of the story. He even manages to work in, I made a note when I was reading the novel, I was like, who's that nun? Mother Felicity? I was like, she is definitely not going to make the adaptation. This is a very long scene with Mother Felicity at the where she kind of becomes clear that she can tell that Smiley's a spy, but she's not going to make a federal case out of it. That scene is, a little bit of that scene actually makes the adaptation. So I really got to take my hat off to Robert Forrest for like working all of this stuff into the mere 3 hours that are available for the audio adaptation. And then you get into the, you know, the exciting bit to the end, like leading up to the, you know, first the really awful, horrible, moving visit to Tatiana at the hospital, getting to see, you know, kind of how scarred and mentally ill she is. And that's a really harrowing scene. And then the climax in Berlin, which, like the Tinker Tailor climax, is the kind of thing that like no studio executive nowadays would accept as the climax of a big spy action thriller. Where basically they just wait at the bridge for Carla to defect, and then he does. Like, it's like there's no reversals, there's no physical peril, there's no fight. It just happens exactly the way Smiley plans it. But the point is, the way that Le Carré depicts it and the way that Forrest adapts it for the audio is, it's the culmination of an emotional story for George Smiley. It's the culmination of a life's work where everyone around him is telling him what a genius he is, and it's just like ashes to Smiley. None of it feels right because he used Carla's techniques to make it happen. It's all about that emotional climax rather than the thrilling spy climax.
Yeah. Well, and you get that emotional climax, and then they tack on this little coda, which just is kind of like lets the air out of it all. I was like, what in the heck is this?
Yes. Particularly, they added something in there that I was like, I'm not sure. Did John Le Carré sign off on that? Which is, you know, a final interior conversation between Smiley and Anne, where he's like talking about how he doesn't really know what it was all for. And that's what the end of the novel clearly wants to leave you thinking. They get Carla, he leaves the lighter on the ground, and Gwillem's like, you won, George. And he's, yes, I suppose I did. And you're just left with that kind of like empty moment there. But instead, in this one, there's this moment, this conversation between inner voice Anne and Smiley, where she kind of tries to come up with some meaning. She's like, you protected people from Carly. What was I protecting? And she said, well, Mendel. You protected Mendel. He's a good man. And the implication being that, like, there was meaning for this because you protected people like Mendel. And George says something, and also you, Anne, as well, which is a bit of kind of, like, hat. Felt like something Le Carré wouldn't write. It was a very rare example of, I mean, sometimes these adaptations have stuff that wasn't in the novels, but it felt like it was in the style of the novels and in the worldview of the novels. Obviously, in any adaptation, you have to write new stuff, but you try to keep it faithful to the world. That felt like a line Le Carré wouldn't write, that it's all worth it if you protect good, honest, common folk like Mendel. That feels like too pat or sentimental a conclusion to reach.
Yeah.
I was very surprised by that. And I know Le Carré could be kind of hands-on with his adaptations. Like, that was the one thing where I was like, I'm surprised he didn't tell them to cut that.
Yeah, it definitely didn't work in my mind either. And, you know, I can see why you want to try and, especially, you know, with that book, loop back to Smiley and Anne and kind of put a pin on that. But it just was a little too pat for my taste, so.
Yeah, for sure.
And then we go on to The Secret Pilgrim. What did you think about that? After like going through all of this, this was really, I think this was the case when it came out. It's kind of a grab bag, right?
Yeah.
All sorts of different little things. So what did you think of that one?
You know, Secret Pilgrim was kind of the revelation of the bunch for me because I had no expectations for it. It was one where I didn't have a chance to revisit the novel. It's one I didn't remember at all from my previous time reading it. I didn't think it was the best, second best, third best of the adaptations or anything like that. But I think I liked it so much better than I was expecting to that it was the one that beat expectations for me. In terms of being an audio drama adaptation, it felt like a little bit that in this particular case, Robert Forrest's approach was just, if you have an actor of Patrick Malahide's caliber playing Ned, I guess it doesn't hurt to turn most of the story over to narration. As an adaptation, this was the one that did the least to transpose the novel into audio drama. Except with a few exceptions that I'll mention later. I think it leaned very hard on the fact that just Patrick Malahide gives a beautiful performance and his inner musings as Ned are interesting to listen to in their own right, even if they sort of paper over a lack of an attempt to kind of dramatize a lot of the scenes in an audio style. I guess what I came away with was it felt to me like a better attempt at what Looking Glass War was doing, which was revisiting a lot of the types of stories that Smiley moved through, but revisiting them from the point of view of a less accomplished spy. But where Looking Glass War was a little heavy-handed, where Avery and Leclerc were just complete incompetent dolts. Ned is just, he's not as good as Smiley. He's a middle of the road. He pulls off some stuff. He has a few triumphs, modest ones, but he has a few modest triumphs. But he's not quite George Smiley. He doesn't quite have that level of talent. He's very often a bystander in these stories. Very often his presence doesn't do a whole lot to change what happens. Just sort of an interesting way of, if Looking Glass War in a way was sort of a reaction to something like Spy Who Came Into the Cold, where the whole operation goes flawlessly on the heels of Smiley's People, where another incredibly ambitious operation ends up going on very successfully. It's interesting to kind of follow that with a story about kind of a mediocrity, not a bad spy, but a middle of the road guy. And he has some stories that kind of echo George Smiley's stories, but in a modest, reduced way. Maybe it's mostly Malahide's performance, but I found it to be a character of pathos for that reason. Nonetheless, here again with the Ben Cavendish story, it's the theme I noticed earlier where closeted gay characters have to learn to function like spies to keep their sexual orientation secret. And, you know, I thought that was interesting. I didn't exactly care for the Hansen story, but I thought that Angus Wright gave a beautiful performance as Hansen, and once again, Malahide's performance, the awe that he held Hansen in. Once again, you've got your pinched, button-down British guy kind of in awe, wishing he could live more like this European guy who's much more passionate and has made these big sacrifices with his life. It's interesting to see that double act coming back. The real prize scene here is the one where it plays most like audio drama, where he has to go and, I guess you call it burning, the scene with Fruin, where he goes to Fruin's flat and gets him to admit everything. Because then suddenly, instead of a narration-dominated story, you've got this wonderful one-act two-hander between Patrick Malahide and Toby Jones. And it's just a couple of actors bouncing off each other in a cracklingly written scene as he very slowly and meticulously breaks this guy. Maybe it's not as great of a triumph as George Smiley would have. George Smiley can break masters, and Fruin is the kind of guy who maybe was already a little bit on the edge of breaking before Ned even showed up. But it's still, you know, a crackling dramatic scene. If you watched it as a one-act play, you'd be on the edge of your seat the whole time. That's by far the best part. If I didn't admire the radio drama craft of it so much, I did find myself moved by Ned's helpless peripheral journey as a not quite as accomplished spy who ends up mostly being a witness or a bystander to a lot of these, as you say, a grab bag of, you know, modest spy adventures.
I did like in the first episode, I do that one story that just sits with me is just the spy who was stupid, you know, right? You know, he just does this stupid thing with these cards and loses them along the way. There's something about that I think really resonates, at least, you know, with me as somebody who would never be able to be a spy. The idea that you're so out of your element, that's the outcome. I think that's, that one really worked for me.
Once again, you see the echo of Looking Glass War. I don't think that like Harry thought it out quite this neatly, but there's a view, like on the heels of a novel about a perfectly executed mission, It's almost like Le Carre does feel the need to kind of remind you most stuff actually falls apart and is done really sloppily. George Smiley's one of a kind. Generally speaking, a lot of espionage is just like ham-fisted screw-ups. And as you say, Jeff, that's exactly the kind of way I would screw up. I would leave an important... I would write up a set of index cards because I couldn't keep the information straight in my head, and then I would absolutely leave them somewhere that was really damaging. I guess the one that kind of set me with me was the one where Smiley comes up with the brilliant solution for the father that wants to believe that his recidivist criminal son was actually secretly a spy, because that was the lie that he told his father, you know, from prison. And Smiley comes up with the ingenious solution. He looks into it, finds out that the guy was just a complete criminal and loser. And Smiley comes up with the ingenious solution of going to the parents and saying, officially, I'm telling you that he never worked for us. The service officially denies that he ever worked with it and allows them to falsely read between the lines and think that maybe their son was a hero. And there's the kind of the touching moment of Smiley coming away going, wow, that was one mission that I pulled off perfectly and left everyone a bit happier at the end of it, which it's a very modest mission.
It's like a reverse Lemus there. The criminal really wasn't a spy.
It was nowhere near as genius as the Lemus mission, but it didn't ruin anyone's life. And yeah, and it left everyone in a slightly better place at the end. There was a little bit of perfection. And then, of course, it ends in this like bone-chilling place where this final, you think that this is going to end in sort of like a melancholy note. But instead, it ends on like a really jarring, upsetting, unhappy note. Ned's final memory of a mission was when he goes to see this awful Sir Anthony Bradshaw guy, who's, you know, this weapons dealer who turns out to be this complete and utter just vicious brute, racist, who has absolutely no intention of cooperating with the government's request at all, tells them all to go screw it. I'm rich and I can get away with whatever I want, and I could just blatantly say that out loud. I hesitate to do the thing of like connecting everything with Trump. That's always very, you know, clumsy. But like one thing that you really see anticipated here isn't specifically Trump, but as anticipation of the era of the powerful oaf who doesn't need to be sly, doesn't need to be clever, doesn't need to be duplicitous because he's too powerful for anyone to stop him. You feel a new world dawning at the end of this final vignette. New world dawning where no longer will all of the wheels within wheels, subtle, intricate techniques of the George Smileys of the world, those won't be needed anymore because there's a new generation of rich brutes coming along who could just get away with anything because they're wealthy. A lot of unpleasant people admire them and they can just kind of say in public what they're doing and there won't be any consequences for it. And I thought that was this kind of jarring way of bringing the story to a close, but I thought it was also very clever and very prescient, and you know, and I think left me with this audio making more of an impact on me than I expected it to.
Yeah, well, and with the Secret Pilgrim, Le Carre was setting up his next novel, The Night Manager, where we see Burr kind of reappears there, and so with that, you can definitely see shades of what was coming with his next book. So,
oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. This is like a slight prequel to The Night Manager.
Yes, a little bit, because Ned appeared originally in the Russia House. He's kind of the narrator of that book, even though he's not a major character. And then he kind of reappears in The Secret Pilgrim.
Oh, wow. I didn't know. I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah. And then they drop Burr at the end of Secret Pilgrim, who reappears in The Night Manager. So, yeah. So there's this kind of loose trilogy that he created there.
Oh, I totally didn't realize that. I've read The Night Manager, but I saw the movie of The Russia House many years ago, but I haven't read The Russia House. Oh, okay. That's really interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, I agree that this is definitely a minor work, and I think it's definitely a minor work in this cycle of audios, but I thought there was value from it that surprised me.
So which of these, of all of these novels, which one would you have wanted to take a crack at it, adapting for audio?
Oh, that's a great question. Wow, you've definitely caught me off guard with that one. I would definitely want to have taken a crack at one that was very Anne heavy. I just said it was the hardest one to adapt to audio, but I think I might have wanted to go for Smiley's People. Maybe it's a toss-up between that and Tinker Tailor. If I had been working with these two writers and I heard about the device of Anne speaking inside George's head, I would have wanted to write that so badly. I think maybe I lean towards Smiley's people just because I would feel like I'd be able to make a mark on that in a way that I feel like is almost impossible with Tinker Tailor at this point.
So
Tinker Tailor has been, you know, adapted in ways that are, you know, it's had two popular adaptations. And then I think Tinker Tailor is the better novel than Smiley's people, but it's been so powerfully adapted. And I don't know what I would bring to the table with it. Whereas Smiley's people has some, is the ingredients that I love. The you could get to use the Anne in her voice. It's got a killer Connie Sachs chapter or whatever. I think that's the one. If Forrest and McKenna had come to me and said, we're going to do these and we'll let you have your pick of which one you're going to do, I would have done Smiley's people. Although, to be quite honest, I don't know that I would have been able to top what Robert Forrest did with it. So, but I think I would have loved the challenge of doing it. I would have loved the challenge of figuring out how to make Smiley's Private Odyssey interesting. Or interesting on audio, I mean to say it.
Sure. So we've talked through the Smiley radio plays. If the BBC or someone else rings you up, says, hey, we need to do a adaptation for A Legacy of Spies or this new Smiley book that Le Carre's son is writing, are you taking that call?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I probably would not be the best person to do it. There's probably something about being a British writer where you just understand that uniquely British English voice of these novels. But since we're talking about, like, you know, a completely made up hypothetical, I would absolutely leap at the chance to be able to play in this sandbox. My gosh, you imagine how great it'd be to sit down and open up a script and start writing lines for Peter Quillam. You're playing in like one of the coolest sandboxes ever. I would absolutely have just a total blast doing that. Yeah, I would absolutely take that call, getting a chance to play with these characters. Although I would try to talk them into believing that Connie Sachs was still alive for Legacy of Spies so I could somehow get her in there. Or does she appear in flashback in that novel?
I think she does. It's been a while since I've read it, but I think she does appear there because we do get a lot of flashbacks to right around that era. So I think she's in there.
Yeah.
Although the problem with that book is that Le Carre really played fast and loose with his timeline. And like he did all sorts of crazy stuff that didn't really match up with his previous books. So that was a little wrinkling to some of the longtime fans, but...
Oh, yeah. No, I heard a little something about that. I might reread that one now that I've gone back to the Smiley novels. I read it kind of ways off from reading the other ones, so I didn't notice that stuff as much. Yeah, I did find myself wanting to reread it because I was so angry at Munt by the end of Spio came out. I was like, wait, did Munt finally get his just desserts in Legacy of Spies? I can't remember. It always made me want to pull it off the shelf to see if anything bad happened a month later because I hated him so much.
Well, any producers out there listening, they'll have to do a Twitter DM or something like that, get a hold of you. So,
yes, please. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to work. Let's do it.
Yeah. Well, so thank you so much for doing this. It's been a great time talking through these. Anything last comments on the? I feel like we've kind of definitely talked them through. Anything else, though, that we missed that you really wanted to make sure to mention?
No, I think we covered all the ground that I was interested in. I mean, again, as you say, like these being produced as a cycle like this, I would say that they are their own experience. They obviously adapt the novels quite faithfully, but they are their own experience in terms of like keeping the Smiley and Anne thread going throughout. And you could read all these novels and then listen to all these audios and feel like you had a separate experience in its own right with these audios. I discovered them because I randomly saw on Twitter one day, someone said, hey, I just want to draw everyone's attention to the best deal on all of Audible. If you're an Audible subscriber for one credit, for one single credit, you can get the entire cycle of the George Smiley audios. And I immediately grabbed it and, you know, listened to them over the next several weeks. That was 2 years ago. I re-listened to them, you know, in advance of this conversation. Even if you know the novels really well, I think there's a tremendous value add from these. If it was your, just speaking to listeners now, if this was your, you know, entry into audio drama, I think it's a great one and, you know, might open the door. I'm definitely in favor of more people becoming fans of audio drama. And I would love for this to be, Smiley audios to be the gateway drug.
Well, I know you're a Doctor Who fan, and
yes.
Tom Baker is the lead in a audio drama of the Russia House. So, you know, definitely give that a listen.
I got to get my hands on that. Yeah, yeah. I did not know that existed. And as soon as I get my next Audible credit, that is definitely what I'm grabbing next.
Before we go, what do you have coming up next? What's the best place for folks to follow what you're up to?
If you go to at Mac Writes on Twitter, somebody else already grabbed Mac Rogers, so I had to come up with something else. So
yeah.
M-A-C-W-R-I-T-E-S. If you go to that on Twitter, I'm using Twitter less than I used to, but I will be consistently using it as an update on when I have projects coming out. Unfortunately, due to the timing of this interview, I've got two projects coming out within the next couple of months that I can't tell you because I haven't been cleared to announce them yet. But I can say that I have both a film and a new audio drama coming out in the next couple of months. So if you all check out Mac at Mac Writes on Twitter, as soon as I am cleared to publicly announce those projects, I will do so in that space because both of those will be coming out yet within the next 2 to 3 months. So I definitely have stuff coming out, and then I'm in writing and production on other audio dramas that'll be coming out over the course of 2024. So I'm going to have a very busy year of new projects coming out. Take a look at my Twitter feed. I won't be using it as much to tweet nonsense, but I will be tweeting updates about my upcoming audio drama work and this one film that I have coming out.
Well, that's great. And I will make sure to put all that stuff in the show notes. And depending on when this is releasing, you may have already announced it. So I'll make sure to put that in there. So folks, check out the show notes at lacaracast.com and you can see that there. So.
Yeah, but this was a tremendous pleasure, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. And I highly recommend folks check out Life After if you're looking for a little sci-fi tinged espionage. I think it's a very fun listen and can kind of scratch that itch. You know, one of the things we didn't mention is you really do kind of have a little bit of the Smiley Ann kind of conversational aspect in that podcast, especially. So I think folks would enjoy that if you're up for a little sci-fi.
Oh, that's true. In a very unexpected way. You're absolutely right. There is something that very much echoes that. So yeah, any of you all listening, if you dig the Smiley Audios, that's true. I always forget to plug for myself. Yeah, yeah. I think folks listening to this podcast, that's probably the closest thing I've written to a spy thriller, Life After. I think
if you look that up on your podcatchers, I think that's the kind of story you'll dig. It's not exactly like a Le Carre story, but it has like a lot of echoes. I think it'll have a lot of the tropes that that you all are likely to enjoy.
Yes, maybe more of a Ned-based audio drama there than Smiley, but yes.
Yes, agreed.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up this episode. You can check the show notes for details on everything we discussed. Feel free to rate the show in whatever pod app you use to help other folks give it a listen. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Like what you're listening to? There's more like it. Barbican Station explores the spy world of Slough House and the Slow Horses created by author Mick Herron. Find it online at slough.house or in your favorite podcast app under Barbican Station. Spybrary's Spy Rewind uses one episode of a classic spy TV show like Mission Impossible, Alias, or Get Smart to talk about the show as a whole. It's at spybrary.com or search for Spybrary in your podcast app. Like the Wolf is a podcast dedicated to the Nero Wolf mystery series created by Rex Stout. The podcast has reviews of all of his stories, plus interviews with a wide variety of Wolf fans. Find it in your podcatcher under Like the Wolf or at likethewolf.com. That's Wolf with an E. They're all novel podcasts, and you can find them all if you type novel.network in your browser. That's novel.network.